We'll start again. Go ahead.
I am Bruce Watson. I've been researching...
You could be Bruce Watson again.
You're Bruce Watson with... who are you with?
Okay. I'm Bruce Watson. I'm currently retired. I taught history and English at Vancouver Community College for a number of years, and for the last 15 years I've been doing research into the maritime and land-based fur trade. And this is why I became interested in the Hawaiians as well as other groups in the fur trade.
I'm Jean Barman. I've written about British Columbia history and taught at the University of British Columbia for the last 15 to 20 years. And I've realized increasingly that you can't write about a place until you write about the average, ordinary people, as well as writing about politics and economics from the perspective of those on top. British Columbia's location on the Pacific at the crossroads to Asia has meant that considerable parts of the population of the province have come from Asia as opposed to coming from Europe or the rest of North America.
Great. Don't move papers, Larry. I can hear it.
What a boring life.
This thing is really, really good. So, how did you get together to work together, and what do you do together?
Bruce and I encountered each other in a number of the same organizations, historical associations, and also originally at a reunion of Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest that was held at Fort Langley, which was an old Hudson's Bay post in 1992, I think. And since then, we started talking about our mutual interests, that I come at the topic from the perspective of British Columbia history, Bruce comes at it from the perspective of the fur trade, and we discovered that we knew about the same individuals, but we knew about different parts of their lives.
Okay. And where do you go to find your research? Where have you gone to do it?
Well, I use the maritime fur trade records from...
Start with I again.
I use the maritime fur trade records from the New England area to capture the early Hawaiians, as well as the British records from various sources, some of which are published, as well as the Hudson's Bay Company archives in Winnipeg. And together we've come up with about 850 Hawaiians altogether, and this is including more recent ones up to about 1900 from the British Columbia Archives as well. Also, the Oregon Historical Society has also been a good source for us.
Okay. Do you want to say anything?
Yeah. My interest in terms of sources is quite different from Bruce's, in that by virtue of working on British Columbia history, I've ended up talking to a lot of people who are descendants, and it's the descendants' stories of their grandparents, great-grandparents who are Hawaiian, who got me interested in the topic.
So, why don't you tell me about the book that you did. Did you do the book together? Or?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell me about the book that you did, generally what it's about, and how you, when it was published.
Okay, you can please do it, and she can take which one she likes.
Oh, boy.
So we just start?
Yeah, I wouldn't know where to start.
Okay. Bruce and I have a co-authored book that's going to come out from the University of Hawaii Press shortly that is called Leaving Paradise, Indigenous Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest, that looks at Hawaiians who left the islands up to the time that America annexed the islands in 1898, and begins at the time that the first Hawaiian came to the Pacific Northwest, which was a woman who arrived in 1787.
I was writing about this and gathering a huge amount of information and realized the amount of interaction. And Jean had a lot of later information, and we put it together, and it was like one and one makes three. We found we had this huge data bank, and we were able to look at it objectively and academically, and so we're putting out this book now on it.
One of the very important points that this book makes, which is critical, I think, for the history of the Hawaiian Islands, and it's why we're very pleased University of Hawaii Press will publish it, is that when we look at the lives of Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest from 1787 through the 19th century, what we discover are indigenous people who are incredibly resourceful, they're self-reliant, they're dependable, they make lives for themselves. Most return home, but a number of them stay and have descendants across the Pacific Northwest to the present day. And this image and this reality is very different from the story that
can
we
you,
usually
I'm
get.
Sorry, can you start with this image and this reality?
Okay. This image and this reality is very different from the story that we get when we look at the history of the Hawaiian Islands from that perspective, when basically it's a tale of indigenous peoples disappearing. They decline in numbers, and they were portrayed by missionary accounts in particular as being unable to cope, as being idle, as being wasteful, as effectively almost fading away because of what they themselves did as opposed to what happened within the larger society. And what happens in the Pacific Northwest is totally at odds with this. And these are the very same people, the brothers, the cousins, the sisters of the people who are depicted so differently at home.
And in the Pacific Northwest, in the records that I've gone through, they were resourceful, reliable, dependable. They made lives for themselves. They were a great asset to the fur trade. And we got an entirely different picture when we looked at it from our point of view here.
Do you want to tell me a bit about the Maria Mahoy book and what she did?
I also have a short book that came out in the summer of 2004 called Maria Mahoy of the Islands, which originated with a descendant asking me if I knew anything about his family. His family took me to his great-grandmother, Maria Mahoy, who was a woman born in about 1855 with an Aboriginal Indian mother and a Hawaiian father who worked in the fur trade, who is illiterate, but all the same, because people remember, and we all have stories to tell, through descendants, many, many descendants, I've been able to put together the story of her life and discover that, yes, she was a tough woman. She knew how to take care of herself. She ended up with an island of her own in her own name. She protected her husbands, her partners, through two marriages. She had a dozen children that she also protected, and many of whom descend into the present day, including Larry Bell.
Did she have any connection with her Hawaiian culture? Did she continue that?
What's clear when you hear the stories of descendants of Maria Mahoy, and I talked to several of her grandchildren who were brought up by her to a considerable degree, is that she valued her Hawaiian origins. She did not have the literal connections with it. She obviously never went back to the islands, but she lived on Southern Salt Spring in an area which had about half a dozen families who were of Hawaiian descent, including some of the original men who'd worked in the fur trade and who lived into the 20th century. And these men together built St. Paul's Catholic Church, which still exists.
Can you start with these men?
Sorry. Okay. These men, together with their neighbors, these Hawaiians men, together with their neighbors, were responsible for building St. Paul's Catholic Church in the first half of the 1880s, which still survives there today, which gave a sense of community that had a settler component to it, but it had a very, very important Hawaiian component. The first two baptisms there, for instance, were of the children of Hawaiians in the fur trade.
Right. So with this new book, what do you want people to get from this? What is the main goal?
Well, we want to make people aware of the Hawaiian presence here and how resourceful they were and how they fit right in and how they worked through the system and how their descendants remained here and what they've done. And it gives a much broader picture of the history of the area, of the Pacific Northwest and British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and southern Alaska.
One of the real difficulties for descendants, and it's very great difficulty indeed, is because of the lack of records in the Hawaiian Islands, is that no descendants in British Columbia or in Washington or in Oregon have been able to trace themselves back literally to families on the islands themselves. For instance, on Molokai, there is a large Kalama family, and they have attended reunions of the Kalama clan in Washington State. But the relationships are not as real as they should be. And we're hoping that with this book, which has 850 biographies in it, as well as a story of 850 biographies of men who have real names and often have multiple names, we're hoping that we will play a role in connecting families in the islands with families that live in the Pacific Northwest.
So if I could ask you some questions about Hawaii and them traveling here and kind of more of the historical thing.
Okay. When you're traveling, that's Bruce.
Okay.
You okay? Do you want to
take it? Yeah, I just want to...
Because the story of how they come is actually quite interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so starting with why they left. So sort of what changed after Captain Cook's visit? What was changing around the time in Hawaii, and why did people leave Hawaii to work?
Well, that's a very good question. I've tried
you
to put
You can't do that because you don't have her question.
Oh, okay.
You have to be self-sufficient in your answer.
Right, okay. Why did the Hawaiians leave Hawaii? That's a very good question. I'm not sure myself. There seems to be a whole variety of reasons, one of which is a pure sense of adventure, another of which is perhaps a breakdown of the culture, the infighting that was going on. The Polynesians were great travelers, and this was really an extension of what they had already been doing for a number of years, and it was part of their oral tradition. And so it was natural for them to jump on a ship, and very often there were people volunteering to go on ships. In fact, the first woman that came here came on the ship, and she wanted to come. This was her desire. Unfortunately, she died while trying to go back to Hawaii, but this was the case. The people were adventurous. They had a great sense of travel, and they wanted to see the world. They wanted to travel.
So then how did the fur trade start? Could you tell me about Hudson's Bay Company and the other companies?
Well, it started much before the Hudson's Bay Company. It really started with China.
Did the fur trade started?
The fur trade started. Do Astoria.
The fur trade started with the furs that were brought back from the Cook expedition and sold in China for a great amount, and word got out to New England as well as England, and so there was a rush of people from New England as well as England to come to the coast here. And of course, Hawaii is a midway point between China and the Northwest coast. It became a natural station for all the ships to stop. So a very large number of vessels went from here to Hawaii, to China, and then they would come back again. And of course, they were picking up people as they went through. So Hawaiians would go to China as well as to the Northwest coast. So that's how they originally got here. And then New York Company, John Jacob Astor's Pacific Fur Company, got into the act, and he brought a large number of Hawaiians here and established a base at Astoria, and that's how the Hawaiians started establishing themselves on land here. Was in 1810, 1811, and then the Northwest Company took that over, and then the Hudson's Bay Company took over the Northwest Company, and so really it was a Hudson's Bay Company effort from 1821, and they succeeded. They had an establishment down in Hawaii, and they brought in a lot of Hawaiians to the Northwest coast.
I also wanted to ask about the forts, what they did on the forts and what their life was like.
Yeah, Bruce, that's you. If you want, or I can do it.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
Well,
the more the merrier, really.
That's okay. No,
so what did the Hawaiians do at the posts? They tended to stick with the posts along the coasts because they were more water-oriented. They had a variety of jobs. They never really rose up in the ranks, but they were very dependable. They were often used as intermediaries between the native people and the traders themselves. Very trustworthy, very dependable. As a matter of fact, in 1842, when one of the officers of Fort Stikine was murdered, it was really the Hawaiians that moved in. There was chaos, and it was the Hawaiians that established order and took the body and made sure things were done correctly and threw out interlopers, etc., and showing just common, decent, good sense. And they intermarried with a lot of local people as well, but the majority of them did return to Hawaii.
Was it difficult for them to go back to Hawaii? How did they do that?
That's interesting. A lot of them.
But you got to start. You can't build on her sentence, on her question.
I think you're getting stressed enough.
No, it's okay. You're doing great. Was it difficult for them to go back to Hawaii? Well, quite a few did go back, but then they would see their family. They would visit their place of birth or wherever their families were, and then they would reenlist and come back here again. So very often they did come back here again, and we don't know exactly why. We don't have written record of that. We can only guess that this was full employment. There was less, maybe things have become a little chaotic in Hawaii. We're not certain.
As to the reasons Hawaiians worked for very long time periods in the fur trade, we have to look at the history of the Hawaiian Islands themselves. So in the 1840s, you have what was a communal system of land where it was used in common within a hierarchical system, being replaced through American initiative in good part by a system of private land holding. And if you were an ordinary Hawaiian and you wanted to claim a piece of land, you had to be there within a two-year window in the late 1840s. And so you have repeated stories of Hawaiians who are working in the fur trade in the Pacific Northwest. They go home for a holiday, or they go home because they think they're going home permanently, and the land that they thought they were going to go back to is now in private hands. It may well be on the way to becoming a sugarcane field. And so you had both push and pull factors. You had the advantage of employment in the fur trade. You had a certain amount of collegiality in the fur trade because there would be three or five, or in case of Fort Vancouver, there would be up to 60 men at the same post. You could continue traditional practices as opposed to what was going on at home, where you might have your family, you might have relatives, but it could become a much more difficult place to make a living. You had an alternative, which became very big, and that was that you could go on a whaling ship and go on a contract in a whaling ship, and that was much harder work. Or you could, from the 1860s, you could go and dig guano on various islands across the Pacific, and that was absolutely dirty, filthy work. So by comparison, the fur trade was quite good. And after the fur trade goes into decline in the Pacific Northwest, after the boundary settlement between Britain and the United States in 1846, a number of Hawaiians come for other reasons. They come and they work in lumber mills. They come on their own. They come as adventurers. So they continue to come to the Pacific Northwest through the 19th century, although it's more difficult to trace. There are some manifests of ships, and you can see, for instance, that during the gold rush in British Columbia in 1858, you would have a dozen or two dozen Hawaiians registered on the ship, often coming with their wives with them. But in many cases, we have their names. We have the fact they come with their wives. And again, because the records are so sparse, we don't know what happened to them.
Could you talk about, I'm interested in Fort Victoria and sort of why it started. Would you be able to talk about that and more information about it?
Well, Fort Victoria, why did it start? Well, it was close to the time of the international boundary when they had to settle that, because this area was in dispute for a number of years from 1818, and they had to establish a final boundary. And as a matter of precaution, in order to secure southern Vancouver Island, because originally I believe the U.S. Congress had drawn a line right through Vancouver Island and cut off the bottom part on what they desired to have as the international boundary, Hudson's Bay Company moved up into the area and established a post, which is now Victoria, and it was under them, it was Fort Victoria.
So they were trying to do they're trying to keep their boundary?
It was essentially a move to establish a foothold in that area so they could secure southern Vancouver Island. Yeah.
And then after Fort Victoria was established, 3 years later, in 1846, you had the International Boundary Settlement. And the Hudson's Bay Company, even though it continued to have some rights to its property south of the border in today's Washington and Oregon states, it needed a firm headquarters. And the headquarters had been Fort Vancouver, and then it is moved north to Fort Victoria. And so once you have the boundary settlement in 1846, Fort Victoria grows in importance as the headquarters for the Hudson's Bay Company in the Pacific Northwest.
Now I want to ask about relations between, or among, I guess, Europeans and Hawaiians and the native peoples. I don't know, perhaps if first, if you're going to say First Nations, if you don't mind explaining what First Nations means, because...
First Nation, for American audience, for an American audience, First Nations is not a very useful word. Do you have time? If you have a little story, you know, for an American audience, the use of First Nations can be a very dangerous word. It's the word that Aboriginal people in Canada use for themselves, but I'm reminded of a story of a black student from the University of Washington who came to see me about the possibility of doing graduate work. And in the middle of the conversation, an Aboriginal woman from Canada came into the office, and I introduced them, and they looked at each other and said, sort of, who are you? And she says, I'm so-and-so. And Jan says, well, I'm First Nations. And the young black woman just stiffened up and said, oh, dear, oh, dear. And finally I said, well, why are you saying, oh, dear? She says, well, is that like Aryan Nation? I don't know if I should be talking to you. So it's a word which, if you think about it, First Nations has sorts of difficulty in being exported wide distances.
Thank you, because if I use this, I need an explanation.
That's an excellent explanation,
yeah. So I'd like to know about the relationships among those three groups.
Well, early on, it seemed to be a matter of a great deal of respect between the fur traders and the Hawaiians, because they were very useful to each other.
I know it's hard, but try not to rub your hands together. Could you
start again?
Early on,
the relationship between the Hawaiians and the fur traders was rather cordial. They seemed to get along. They seemed to respect each other. They had their own areas of work, and they fulfilled these functions. And they would come to the rescue of each other if necessary, and this was important in those days. And they depended on each other for survival. So there was, I'm just guessing from the records, there seemed to be a certain amount of affection on both sides. It wasn't necessarily discrimination like we seem to think it these days, but there was a certain dependency.
And then what about with the native people?
With the native people, that's interesting. At times there was suspicion, but at other times they did couple with native people, and they had families. So there was a whole range there. But they were often used by the traders as intermediaries between the native people and themselves. They were a kind of buffer, and that was later on. And they served that function fairly well.
My sense is that Hawaiians treated Aboriginal men and Aboriginal women very differently. The fur trade, people in charge of the fur trade, the Hudson's Bay Company, used them often in defense positions against Aboriginal men. But on the other hand, they had families with Aboriginal women. And in doing that, they were no different than virtually everyone else in the fur trade, whether you were there from Scotland, you were there from French Canada, you were there from England. If you were in the fur trade for any length of time, it's almost certain that you would have a family with a local native woman. And at some point, you might move on, or the woman might decide that she was going to move on, because these are women who are just equally tough. But don't distinguish, I think, how the Hawaiians behaved toward Native women from the way that anybody else in the fur trade behaved toward Native women.
And I'd like to hear some stories. You know, it might be good to tell perhaps Mariah's father's story, if you know part of that, just because, since I also have Larry talking about his story. But then also, if you have some stories in your book, you know,
we do have stories of people,
good anecdotes about their lives and what they did.
I'll let you think of one while I do that. Many of the men in the fur trade who came from Hawaii are very little known. We have their names in the records and not much else. And one of the men who comes into this category is a man called Mahoy. We're not quite sure even which Mahoy is, who has a wife, who's an Aboriginal wife, has a daughter called Mariah, born in sometime in the mid-1850s. Now, how we know about a daughter like this is very often, if through the recollections of families to some extent, but also through baptismal records, through marriage records. And with Mariah, she appears out of obscurity when her first child, by a sea captain from Maine via California, is baptized in 1871. And from that, from these records, which are very small in themselves, but nonetheless extremely important, we know something about her parentage. We know how old she was. She was about 15 or 16 at the time. We know that the man that she had partnered with was in his late 20s, and it was often this big age differential at the time for most similar marriages. And we know, again, where she came from, where her partner came from. And it's from these little tiny pieces of information that we've been able to put together the stories of a considerable number of Hawaiians who, in fact, had families with Aboriginal women, or in some cases had families with the half-Hawaiian daughters of earlier liaisons between Hawaiian men and local women.
Think of a story you want
to
tell?
I can't. My mind has gone blank at this point. I'm trying to think of. There's so many of them.
William Taiwai, the one who completely goes berserk at Nisqually.
Oh, berserk! Well, what about the one that deserted and went off in the gold rush and came back?
That sounds good. I like that.
Yeah. William did. That was William. Wasn't it T-A-W-A-I-E?
Was that Tawai? That was Tawai. One of the ones. There were several of the Hawaiians that actually went off and joined the
gold
rush.
That was
going to
be my next question, though. Yeah. Who deserted or rebelled?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Was there a certain amount of rebellion within the ranks? Of course there was, especially when opportunities presented themselves. For example, at Nisqually, when gold was found elsewhere, Fort Nisqually, when gold was found elsewhere, some of the Hawaiians did go off and try their luck at gold, and they came back and they were hired on back again because most people did not find gold. And the same happened in the California gold rush. Some of the Hawaiians went south and some of them returned without gold, and they were welcomed back into the fold again because they were usually dependable people. But they did strike out on their own periodically.
The Hawaiians were not just in the fur trade. The Hawaiians were extremely important for the first generation of missionaries that came to the Pacific Northwest. Virtually all of the missionaries in the 1830s had Hawaiian help. Now, the reason they had Hawaiian help is very interesting, because they had come supposedly to save Aboriginal people in the Pacific Northwest, but they didn't really trust them. And they, if you read what they were really saying, they weren't terribly keen on them. But the Hawaiians were, in fact, their buffer between places from where they had come, which was almost always Boston, New England, and they were in very, very close contact with their fellow missionaries in the Hawaiian Islands all the time, and with the indigenous people. And so you had, for instance, both Hawaiians of the first generation, but you also had several sons who had been born to Hawaiian men at Fort Vancouver and local Aboriginal women, who then came and, in a sense, nurtured the missionaries. For instance, Narcissa and Marcus Whitman, who were became notorious because, in fact, they managed to get themselves murdered along with a lot of other people in the early 1840s. But Narcissa Whitman had a young Hawaiian boy of about 12 who, in fact, gave her comfort on an absolutely everyday level, and she was convinced that she was going to convert in the way in which earlier missionaries in New England had converted young Hawaiians. And it's this young boy who, in fact, goes and tries to save her daughter when her daughter of 2 and 3 years is almost drowned.
Sorry, could you start with goes and tries?
Okay, I should get, what's the name of the, I want to get the boy. Should I get the boy's name? He would be good if we had his name. I can't think of what it is. Do you want me to go and find it for you? The young Hawaiian?
If you want to, sure.
Yeah. If you want it, do you want it or you don't care?
It doesn't okay. really matter.
Okay, let me start again. When Marcus and Narcissa Whitman's young daughter disappears and they look for her frantically all around the missionary encampment, it's this young Hawaiian boy of about 12 who first finds evidence that, in fact, she has gone into the water and played and drowned, which is what happens. And so at the time that we read in the missionary records and we read in the missionary history of the United States about poor Narcissa Whitman and she lost her child, what we don't really read about is that the individual who comforted her when she did so was this 12-year-old half Hawaiian, half Native boy.
Any other good stories you think would go along with this? Anyone moving forts or?
Let me try one more. a number of the, we have to remember that the fur trade lasted from, we have to remember that the land-based fur trade lasted from 1810 until the 1850s, and this meant that there were a generation of children of the Hawaiian men who worked there, who are born by Aboriginal women and who grow up. A Hudson's Bay Company was quite good about hiring sons on to work for them, and it did so with a number of the Hawaiians. But if we have, when we look at what happened, we realize that some of them fit in very well and did their job, and others didn't. And one of these sons who really couldn't cope was a son of Hawaiian called Tai, and this was William. And William was working at Fort Nisqually and meant to be looking out the sheep. He was treated as if he was somewhere between the local Aboriginal people and being an Hawaiian. And he increasingly is unable to cope. He gets into fights. He loses part of his arm. He escapes for a while to the gold rush and comes back. But eventually, he just disappears and he dies. He drowns. And so you can follow through two and three generations of Hawaiians through the fur trade. If there had been a sister, and where there were daughters, these daughters were almost always married to young French Canadians or Scots who are working in the fur trade. And so they disappear into the edges of settler society in the Pacific Northwest. Sons and daughters of Hawaiians who worked in the fur trade live very different lives because of their gender. Young men fit into the edges of the fur trade and were hired on, whereas daughters slid into the edges of settler society in the Pacific Northwest. And there are cases, there are stories that one reads, and there are newspaper accounts of, again, having only a glimmer of this identity of being Hawaiian two or three generations back, and families and descendants discovering that, yes, this grandmother, this great-grandmother was a half-Hawaiian woman, which has been increasingly part of this process of discovery that a lot of Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest are now experiencing. In 1992, there was a reunion of Hawaiians held at Fort Langley in the Fraser Valley in British Columbia, and much to the surprise of the descendant who organized it, there were something like 200, 300 people who came, and they came from all over the Pacific Northwest. Throughout the afternoon, people would talk about their families, they would talk about their inheritance, and a number of people discovered, in fact, that they were related. They were second cousins and third cousins and never encountered each other because their Hawaiian-ness had never before been something that they could bring to a public place and talk about with real excitement and with real beginnings of understanding. Did Larry tell you about the woman from the newspaper in Honolulu who came in the early 1970s?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was also... There was a transition between the maritime fur trade and the land-based fur trade, and several Hawaiians, which I pick up on maritime fur trade records, they start appearing on land-based records. So there probably was a certain kind of affinity with the land here, once they realized that it was a place of employment, and they would re-enlist and join up with a land-based fur trade company like the Hudson's Bay Company or even the Northwest Company. They would come back again.
We talk a bit about the differences between what happens in the U.S. and Canada after the boundary settlement. The lives of Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest changed once the fur trade went into decline with the boundary settlement in the middle of the 19th century, but it changed very differently between the two sides of the border. Oregon was a settler society. You had the Oregon Trail, you had the movement to create Oregon as a territory, and one of the most important elements of this movement was that for people who came from the United States was it was going to be a white place. They were determined they were not going to have blacks there, they were not going to have free blacks there, and they were also determined there were going to be no civil rights for Hawaiians. And so Hawaiians are part of all of the anti-black legislation that is put in place in the 1840s. There are miscegenation laws which said that a white person could not be married to a black person, and also a white person could not be married to a Hawaiian. And these laws remained in place until the middle of the 20th century. In British Columbia, in part because it began as a British colony. And the Hudson's Bay Company was a quasi-British governmental organization. The Hawaiians were always treated with the same civil rights as everyone else did. Everyone else was. So Hawaiians could vote, Hawaiians could own land, and a whole number of them then settled on the Gulf Islands precisely for this purpose. One of the intermediate places of settlement for Hawaiians was on San Juan Island, which was in dispute between Canada, or between Britain and the United States, and was finally resolved in favor of the United States at the beginning of the 1970s. And as a consequence, some a dozen and a half Hawaiians moved north to Canada precisely because they wanted to have their civil rights. So it's not as if they're passive kind of individuals. These were men and their families who knew exactly what they wanted out of life. They knew what they wanted to do in the Pacific Northwest. They settled on Salt Spring Island, which is where Larry Bell's family was. It was where William Nakana was, whose ancestors include the Roland clan, and a whole number, hundreds of other people who live across British Columbia into the present day.
Well,
I was trying to think.
No, well done. Yeah. No,
did they settle into Maple Ridge too?
Yeah, from Fort Langley. No, yeah, that's also interesting.
Yeah. All I can think of right now is the Hawaiians with VD for some reason, because there was all kinds of Hawaiian. I don't know whether that's
important. But there are more so of everyone else. So you don't want typify.
No.
There are less Hawaiians that had venereal disease, and I think there were other people in the fur trade.
I've got 5,600 names in my data bank, and the Hawaiians are part of that. And I'm trying to recall, just certain
where the
stories.
Hawaiians are.
And I can recall all kinds of stories except the Hawaiians.
Well,
right,
it's one other story about Hawaiian individuality that we can talk about, and that's for the Americans, and that's Astor, John Jacob Astor in Astoria.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is we got to do the American thing.
Yes.
That's why we have a whole chapter on Astor.
Yeah.
In the book, we have a chapter on Astoria. Astoria is an absolutely fascinating phenomenon. It was started as a fur trading post by John Jacob Astor in 1810, 1811, and was the first land-based fur trade in the Pacific Northwest. Its interesting aspect is that for its labor, it depended in good part upon Hawaiians. It took a gamble. The ships that were bringing supplies for Fort Astoria stopped on the way at the Hawaiian Islands, and they picked up, each of the ships picked up a dozen Hawaiians, and these Hawaiians were the backbone of Astoria for the 2 and 3 years of its operation. And because Astoria is so much part of American culture, there are something like half a dozen first-hand accounts of what happened on a day-to-day level. And when we put these six accounts together, what we discover is that we can actually trace what the Hawaiians were doing. We can trace the way in which they were building Fort Astoria. They were maintaining the garden. They were doing the hunting. They were doing the fishing. They were keeping that place alive, and they were keeping that place active for the 3 or 4 years that it's very important to realize is significant for when we think about American history, when we think of American expansion westward. But when the histories of Astoria have been written, have they mentioned the Hawaiians? If the Hawaiians are mentioned, they get maybe half a sentence. Maybe they're in there one word. James Rhonda has written extensively on Astoria, and he has managed to tell the story just not seeing the Hawaiians, who are doing virtually everything there. And the reason we know they're virtually doing everything there is because they're doing it in the published accounts. But they're invisible to them, as they're invisible to most American historians. Now I'm getting vicious.
yeah, calm down.
It's true. There's no James Rhonda is amazing.
No, another thing they did do, another thing they did do at Astoria was they became intermediaries. There was often conflict between natives and the fur traders themselves, and very often the Hawaiians were put on guard duty. They were sent out as guards to protect the fur traders themselves. So they had a variety of functions. They were in the gardens, as Jean has said. They did guard duties. They were fishing. They were building. They were doing all kinds of things. They were essential to that operation, really, and they get very little mention for it.
Do you have any thoughts about Fort Vancouver?
Oh, Kanaka Village.
Yeah, we need Kanaka Village, yeah. The center of fur trade operations in the Pacific Northwest was Fort Vancouver, which is now a National Historic Site in the United States. It's located at Vancouver, Washington, just across from Portland. Hawaiians were a significant part of the workforce at Fort Vancouver. There were up to 50 and 60 Hawaiians working there alongside French Canadians, alongside people who came from Scotland. And again, just as it had been 10, 20 years before at Astoria, it was Hawaiians who were the important backbone in terms of the everyday labor that sustained Fort Vancouver from its formation in the early 1820s up to the boundary settlement a quarter of a century later. The Hawaiians were so prominent at Fort Vancouver that the area where the laborers lived, where all of the ordinary workers lived, was known as Kanaka Village. And Kanaka is the word in Hawaiian for a person. And a lot of the fur trade, Hawaiians, people from the Hawaiian Islands were often known as Kanakas, and the location at Fort Vancouver was Kanaka Village, which tells us a lot about who was living there and who was prominent on the everyday level. One of the elements of the Hudson's Bay Company we have to remember is that regardless of where you were from as an ordinary worker, you had no chance to rise in the hierarchy. If you were hired as a laborer, whether you were English, you were Scots, you were French Canadian, or you're Hawaiian, you would not become an officer or a person in charge. So the fact that the Hawaiians did not rise and ever become in charge was not because they're Hawaiians. It was because they were hired as laborers on a 2 or 3 year contract. And that was the way the company operated, regardless of how well you did. Unless you started as an officer or a clerk at age 16 or 18, you were going to be a laborer all your life.
There were occasional variations of that, but largely what you say is true. It was, in fact, a kind of feudal system where people's stations were fixed. And as Jean said, if you were Hawaiian or Scot or French-Canadian or whatever, it didn't really matter. You were fixed in that position. Yeah.
So what other nationalities were working there? Were there more than that? Like, could you give me a list of who was working for the company?
The Hudson's Bay Company or the Maritime Fur Trade Company or companies?
From what countries did people come
from? Okay, well, the Maritime Fur Trade, there was East Indian Lascars who were working there. There were Chinese. There were Africans. There were French. There were Scots. There were English. There were people from Switzerland. There were people from Germany. You name it. There was the odd Italian, and of course the Spanish were here as well. And in fact, some of the Spanish ended up down in Hawaii, working down there. They left from here, and they went down to California, and then they headed over to Hawaii. And one of the Africans in the fur trade, for example, he had been a slave, and he went down to Hawaii, and he established himself in Waikiki. And he set himself up on 6 acres there, married two women at the same time. They were both, I believe they were sisters. And he set up a hospital. So he looked after six seamen. He set up a racing area for horses. He had a grog shop. He had a dairy. He had gardens. So there was a lot of interaction with various kinds of people who had worked here on the coast.
Was that someone at the door?
I don't know.
Follow up on that. It's just, if you worked in the fur trade and you had a job as a laborer, you had probably a 3-year contract in which you agreed to work, to be employed. And at the end of that, you would get your return passage home. So if you were hired on in Honolulu as a Hawaiian, you agreed to be in the Pacific Northwest for 3 years and you would be returned home. What did you get? You got a yearly wage. You also got board and room, in the sense that you got a place to live that you probably built yourself as men did with Kanaka Village, where they built their own little huts or houses in whatever style they could scrabble the lumber for. You also then got a weekly ration of food. You worked for 6 days, and when you quit work on Saturday, you would get, so many pounds of salmon, so many pounds of potatoes, maybe something else, depending upon what was available. You might get some flour, you might get some sugar. One of the real advantages for the Hawaiians was that the cheapest food to give to workers was very often salmon. Now, they were very keen on fish, but it was something which, for a lot of the other workers who came from, particularly French Canada, who came from Scotland, it was an incredibly boring kind of routine. But your life in the fur trade had a certain regulated quality to it and a certain dependability to it over those 3 years to which you committed yourself.
Speaking of salmon, the Hudson's Bay Company established more than just the fur trade. It established fish trading in fish and lumber, spars, etc. And one of the exports that they sent to Hawaii was salmon. And very often the salmon would arrive in casks, but it would be slightly off. And so they had to spice it up. And we believe that one of the reasons, or one of the sources of Lomi Lomi in Hawaii, is in fact this original slightly off salmon that arrived that they had to sell. So they spiced it up a bit.
Kanaka William, we should talk about. You want to talk about Kanaka William?
Oh, Kanaka William,
he's good.
Yeah.
How about the Hawaiians are misbehaving at Fort Vancouver?
Yes.
Here.
Boy. Yeah, well, one of the Hawaiians that was interesting, who was trained by the missionaries themselves and sent up to Fort Vancouver, was Kanaka William Kalihilihi. I think, wasn't that his name?
Yeah.
It was what? Okay, do that one again. One of the Hawaiians that was of interest was William Kalihilihi, who was sent up from Hawaii. He had been trained by the missionaries there. He established a church in Fort Vancouver, and he used to have services, but not everybody cooperated, and he had great difficulty getting Hawaiians to come to the services. He eventually stayed on there, and he was more or less pushed out when the U.S. Army was asserting itself and burning down the villages. They actually were tearing down his house while he was in it. And they used him as an example of what not to do. And so the army atoned for its sins and decided not to do that again. Anyway, William came to Victoria, which was a natural move. That was the new headquarters. And he was in the employ of the Hudson's Bay Company and doing a variety of things, and even an interpreter for somebody who, Hawaiian, who had killed his wife, mother, and father-in-law and children, and he was an interpreter for that. That was Peter Kakua who did the killing. So William served his function for a number of years. Yeah, Peter Kakua, he was an interesting person. He had worked at a couple of the posts and eventually retired to the Nanaimo area. And he had drank too much and in a dispute had, in a state of intoxication, had killed virtually his whole family and had tried to make an escape. And what is interesting is that at the inquest and the jury that was looking into it, they pleaded for his life because they said that he was not a Christian and therefore he should not be under Christian laws to get a death sentence. Anyway, their appeal didn't work because he was hanged just outside of Nanaimo for his crimes. In fact, there's a bay named after him there now.
The missionaries who came to the Hawaiian Islands had one of their first activities to try to make everybody in Hawaii literate so that they could read the Bible, they could come to salvation. And one of the consequences of this was that there was a fairly high level of literacy in Hawaiian among a number of the Hawaiians who come to British Columbia, come to Washington, Oregon from the 1830s onward. But Kanaka William, who had been the missionary at Fort Vancouver and moved to Fort Victoria, is one step beyond that, because he became very much of a conduit for bringing Hawaiian newspapers. He subscribed to Hawaiian language newspapers from Honolulu. They were sent to him in Victoria, and then he shared them out every time they came with a number of the other Hawaiians who were living in Victoria. And we know this because, in fact, when you look in the Hawaii State Archives in Honolulu, there are letters from him, Hawaiian, which are describing this, which we fortunately were able to have translated. Hawaii was an independent kingdom in the 19th century, and they had consuls. There was a Hawaiian consul in Victoria. There was a Hawaiian consul in Port Townsend, which was a large settlement, a large lumbering settlement on Puget Sound in today's Washington state. And there were consuls in other places in the Pacific Northwest. And they provide another glimpse into the lives of Hawaiians, because they mainly encounter Hawaiians when they get into trouble. But what we do see is that they come as sailors. We do see that we have a poor man who is working as a baker in the Port Townsend area in Washington. And eventually he just becomes incapacitated and can't work anymore. And so the local folk, now this is south of the border, so there's a lot of discrimination. They don't want to have responsibility for Hawaiians who are considered to be comparable to black folk. And they appeal to the consul to give him a passage back to the Hawaiian Islands, which he finally does get. And so it's not easy to get glimpses of their lives in the Pacific Northwest, but there is this range of sources which, when put together, do tell us, to a very considerable extent, how people live their lives.
Another interesting aspect is the number of fur traders that were working on the coast, both in the maritime fur trade and the land-based fur trade, who went down to Hawaii, intermarried with Hawaiians, and eventually became part of the establishment. A variety of people did. One, John Dominus, was working up here in the maritime fur trade in opposition to the Hudson's Bay Company. His son married a person who became eventually Queen Liliuokalani, who was the last queen. John Young, one of the first settlers down there, who was actually taken and held, along with Isaac Davis. Both of them spawned children who ended up as members of council or part of the Hawaiian family or whatever. So there was a lasting lineage. And one Hudson's Bay Company employee, Mr. Rhodes, went down there and established himself, and eventually his brother ended up as Hawaiian consul up here in Victoria.
So there was like a back and forth.
There was a back and forth. There was a tremendous amount of movement, of integration, and not only trade, but people movement, and people of mixed descent who were coming back and living up here, mixture of Hawaiian and fur traders.
Great. So is there any point, perhaps a point of thesis or something where you disagree, the two of you?
I don't think so.
No, we've worked at
it. I know it's very historical.
We've come at it at different, we've come at it from different perspectives. And I think that our position in the book represents our conversations. It represents a meshing of our interests. And the exciting part of what we've done, we think, is that we had separate windows into Hawaiians in the Pacific Northwest, and then we began to bring these together 3 or 4 years ago and discovered that as a consequence we could piece together lives over a longer period of time. An interesting example is someone called John Cox, who comes from the Hawaiian Islands on Astoria ships in 1810-1811. He then goes with David Thompson, who's an explorer, back to Montreal. He hops on a ship in order to come back to the Pacific Northwest. He goes to London. He comes back around the Horn. He comes back to Astoria at about the time that the War of 1812 is going on. And then he doesn't just disappear from the records. We find him in the 1820s, where he's one of a group of Hawaiians who are caught stealing some trade goods for their Aboriginal wives. Then we find him later on at Fort Vancouver, where he's a pig herd. We have accounts from visiting missionaries who are introduced to Old Cox, as he's known. His portrait is painted by Paul Kane, who's a very famous Canadian painter, and he finally dies at Fort Vancouver in 1849. So he has essentially spent 4 decades in the Pacific Northwest. We have no account from his perspective, but by putting together all these little tiny pieces, we get a good sense of this man who is a long-term trusted employee who has been essentially to Montreal, he's been to London, he's sort of seen the world and has decided that the Pacific Northwest is the best place for him.
Is there anything final that you want to say or people to take from this?
I can't think of anything. I think we've covered all the bases here.
If you're satisfied.
Yeah.
I think you guys have been really good. Okay, thank you.
One of the relative latecomers, Pacific Northwest, was a man called George Camano, about whom we've been able to find out quite a bit. He always told the story to his family that he had been shanghaied from Hawaii to the Pacific Northwest. We think he probably came with the Hudson's Bay Company. Who knows, he may have been shanghaied onto the ship with the Hudson's Bay Company. In any case, he works off of northern Vancouver Island, but then he becomes involved with the local Catholic mission up there. He works for the mission on a very remote island off of northern Vancouver Island called Harbledon. And when the mission leaves, he, with by this time a local Aboriginal woman, just stays on Harbledon Island, and he has a family of 10 children there. He raises the children. They are obviously a very close family. He is visited by various traders and merchants who go up the coast. We have someone well known who's collecting Indian artifacts who stops in and talks to him and has a long conversation, and we see this from this account. He finally dies in about 1918, but his family is scattered all over British Columbia, and the story that they all take from him is that he didn't want to leave the island. He was afraid that someone would shanghai him like they shanghaied him when he was young, but this time they would take him back to the Hawaiian Islands, and he didn't want to go.
Yeah, the only thing I can add to that is that his wife was very often not at home. She was a person of some importance, and she was potlatching all up and down the coast. And potlatching had a social, political significance. And so she was establishing all these relations all up and down the coast, very often being absent from home, having her own potlatches. But the family seemed to work and work very well. So he was all part of this whole thing as well.
One thing I didn't say was, what have you learned from doing research on this book? Anything that you've taken for your own self?
One of the most important elements we've taken from doing research on this book is how you can look at something that seems to be fairly small. When we got together and we started writing the book, we were writing a book only about a group of men away from home in the Pacific Northwest, and we didn't think of the implications for the Hawaiian Islands themselves. We weren't aware of the fact that many of these men went back and forth repeatedly in their lives. We weren't aware that the history of the Hawaiian Islands itself, as Indigenous Hawaiians are usually interpreted, is so very, very different. And we had something which runs against the grain, I think, of American history and of Hawaiian history, and it runs against this notion that the United States had to take over the Hawaiian Islands in 1898 because, in fact, Indigenous Hawaiians were somehow deficient and couldn't cope for themselves.
What I found interesting was the amount of interaction that went on between the Hawaiian Islands and the Pacific Northwest, and how, A, the number of Hawaiians that came up here and how they functioned, and B, the number of people that dropped off in the fur trade and became part of Hawaiian history. And there was a huge interaction that went on. And it's continuing to this day. And it's something that we're not really aware of. And so I think this came through when we were writing.
The other important element that we had not been aware of, and I think no one has been aware of before, is how important the Hawaiians were to the first generation of missionaries in the Pacific Northwest. They would not have survived in the 1830s and the 1840s if they had not had They had Hawaiian cooks, they had Hawaiian houseboys, they had Hawaiians who were nurturing them in every kind of practical, everyday way. Now, if we read about the Oregon Trail, we read about the Protestant advance into Oregon, beginnings of common schooling, whichever kind of American history that we read about, we don't read about the Hawaiians as an integral part of that. And they were there. They were there on that everyday level.